Accession number 16755, Reel 4.
Colonel Strangeways, Reel 4. You were saying that you did, I think you were indicating rather than saying, that you did find resistance from some commanders to whom you made requests.
Yes. It sounds very rude, but it's true. The good commander, or chief of staff, was never any problem at all. But there were some who had become totally inflexible or feeling that they knew best. And they could be difficult. Very occasionally, you ran certain tricks of the trade, as it were. I had to say, right, I will report back to General Alex that I can't undertake this operation. And that would always settle the party.
That'd be automatic.
Yes. I mean, the real officer, he doesn't look how many pips you've got on your shoulder. He looks at where you've come from and what your authority is. And probably the fewer pips you have on the shoulder, the better, because he knows you're doing your best and he will look after you. But you do occasionally meet. I met it with the Americans because they've got a entirely different view of life. But by and large, well, we succeeded, because we succeeded brilliantly. I mean, beyond our own expectations.
How did you judge your success? Was it by whether the Germans did what you wanted?
Oh, yes,
to do?
When a division appeared in front of you, having you moved it down the wrong place entirely. Well, it was rather terrifying, because you only got about 25 men there. You were pleased. You go back to Alex's meeting and he would indicate obliquely that it was okay. And Dick McCrary, of course, was terrific. No, we could tell, you could never bluff them. You either succeeded or you didn't. And I'm glad to say, mostly we succeeded beyond expectation.
What were the principal techniques you used in inducing the Germans to do these things?
You want to study what they do. They were dependent primarily on wireless traffic and observation. So you got at him through air observation and wireless traffic. Now, again, you've got to know something about wireless traffic. I learned very early on in my getting into this side of life, that the operators who in those days were using Morse and a certain amount of verbal, but Morse particularly. Now, any interceptor learned to recognize an individual operator. He's got a signature. So it's no good you pretending somebody else is him. You've got to use him to do what you want to do. That's why I'd get the chaps, the right people, down to where I was, where they weren't going to be.
So you were borrowing signals.
So I was borrowing signals. And their officers. So who were the recce? Who went out on recce to recce sites for camps, whatever it might be, whatever it may be, and who were the operators to go with them. So you must have those two together. Now, this is simple, and they enjoy it. You brief them all. And I used to give a map reference somewhere in the desert, and they would turn up, and I'd brief them, tell them the story, tell them what they're going to do and why they're going to do it.
Did you take them into your confidence?
Oh, absolutely.
So they all knew exactly what they were doing.
Exactly what they were doing. And the you've got to be totally honest and tell them. And say, when you get back, don't, for goodness sakes, tell this, because it'll upset the party. And they won't upset. They're involved in it themselves. And you tell them openly. I used to sit on my Jeep on the hood with them all round, and I used to tell them. And it never failed. Because they wanted to help. And they could see the sense of it. And they'd realise that their security had got to be a bit better than it was before. And I used to monitor. I had a monitoring set in my car, and I could listen to units talking, and I could spot where things were going wrong. They were talking too much, they were being stupid. Of course they get stupid. They don't mean to be stupid, but this happens. So you have to watch. I watch my own side as much as I watch the enemy side.
What did you think of the Germans' signal security and procedures?
Well,
did they ever attempt or succeed in doing the same thing to us as you were doing
no.
to them?
No, they had no idea. You see, we were blessed. I was an ultra reader, so I could read all the intercepts from Bletchley Park. I used the ultra communications. I could go into any ultra place, say, back to cabinet offices, and they'll send the message straight back to cabinet offices. And all was done by one-time pad, perfectly secure, and they were all run by the RAF. They were absolutely marvellous, and they were fun. You suddenly appear, they'd never met me before, you'd appear and they'd say, I'm afraid this is not for... I say, yes, it is. Do you know so-and-so? Do you know somebody else? Ask them if you can talk to me. That's it. It's all right. We've known about you, but we hadn't met you. I said, it's all right. And I'd give them the message that I wanted, short. Go straight back to Bevan in the cabinet offices. And I'd say, please counter the following. And the following, in effect, would be my story. A little short story. And the word counter meant use everything you can to put this over. Now, he had access to all the theatres and they'd do the work. I mean, the local agent who was turned over would do his stuff on direction.
The double agent. Oh, yes. In court.
And I didn't have to do it. I simply sent it to Bevan. And this is how we worked. And I had no record of that at all. Don't even have any records.
Now, you mentioned that besides signals traffic, the I mean, here, were you counting on the Germans relying just on traffic analysis or upon them actually reading?
You're relying on all sorts of things. Newspapers published in somewhere in Europe. Somebody going on leave. Somebody being sacked. It's unlimited.
Were you able to use prisoner of war correspondence as a means?
No. I didn't bother about that. If Bevan had got anything tucked away, he would use it. He used to... You see, they had a big committee which had to take what I'd asked to be done, how they did it.
What about air reconnaissance, which was the other principal means mentioned?
Well, I used to take, if I was going, for instance, one operation comes to mind, one of my requirements was that I should have a battery of Bofors, I think they were called in those days.
40mm
light. Yes. Because if the enemy came over, where I meant to have a whole corps or division, he would expect to find something. But if he gets shot at like blazes, there must be something down there. And if they manage to knock one of them out, it's marvellous. They mustn't knock them all out, one out, it's fine. But you've got to make the situation on the ground, where you are not, but where you theoretically are, you've got to make it convincing. But you can't make it convincing to the Air Force unless there's some ACAC to cover it, in those days, anyhow. So I used to get, this is the kind of thing I used to put in my demand note for so-and-so, so-and-so, and they would be directed down to my little RV.
Did you make a lot of use of physical dummies?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes,
who actually made those for you?
You would ask for a little party of engineers. You provide them with some Hessian or something and explain to them how you do this kind of job, and they get on and do it. But that was in North Africa. When we got back to England, we got everything properly organised.
So North Africa was really doing things ad hoc.
Yes, it was, because it was an ad hoc position anyhow. It was a desert. It's a wonderful place to have war, but you don't involve the civilians. But when we got into Italy, it was different. And when we got to Italy, I asked Alex if I could send an officer back to America to have dummy tanks made and various things made. And he agreed. I sent a wonderful man who unfortunately got killed in an operation of ours. I'm afraid I've forgotten his name. It's all, he'd been stage manager of Glyndebourne.
So he was a scene. He knew about scenery.
Oh yes. Well, he was a man. He was a wonderful person. I forget his name now. Oh, dreadful. But he went. I sent him to America with a little short note, theoretically from Alex. And he gathered together all the makers of rubber things and explained to them what he wanted, and which were the tanks. We'd got, in England, we were beginning to do such things. And he said they must be out here so and so into Italy. He came back and he said, "It's all right, sir. They're going to make them. They'll be over so and so." And they were. And that was, the Americans loved that kind of challenge. And that was the beginning of really getting an organized force together.
You were saying earlier on that dealing with the American military could be difficult. Presumably, when you were working for Alex, you had to liaise with the Americans and deal with them. What were the particular...
They'll trouble with... You see, their staff duties then, I know what they are now, everything was on a... There was a man called the executive.
Executive officer.
And he had to supervise everything. No message could be sent. If you were in a brigade, the executive could only send the message. Up and up, go, however high you went, only the executive. So, if, for instance, me making a signal to whatever it was, I do it direct, finish, because I was a staff officer. That, in the American system in those days, and what's this now, was impossible. I had to submit my message to be examined by the executive to see that it would go. And the odds are, he'd say no. Or he'd want a complete explanation, which you wasted your flipping time, you've probably been off on a recce before then. And towards the end of the campaign in North Africa, I used to go down to the American sector, and everything would be recorded. There'd be a chap sitting at the meeting, recording every single thing that was said. And, oh.
Sounds like you found them rather ponderous.
Well, they didn't trust their officers.
They didn't trust their officers?
No. Well, look, if I write a message on behalf of a plan which has been approved by the commander, I'm not going to write the wrong message. If I am, I should be sacked at once. Go. Fine. But how does anybody else know that message is right or wrong? It's a waste of time. And a waste of time in war is to me a sin. It's wrong. You've got the fellows to get on with the job. Well, I trained an American team to do reception before D-Day. And poor chap was sent off. And every single plan he had to go and be scrutinized by the executive.
What level was that? What,
This was the top level. And he couldn't move. Because he couldn't run his own show. He'd seen what we were doing. He'd been alongside me for, 3-4 months. He'd see me suddenly say, right, do so-and-so. Well, it would happen. It must happen. There's only, and I taught him that there's only one person who got the picture, and that's him. If he makes a mistake, that's his own fault. Nobody else's.
Was he himself okay in the way in which he was
Billy Harris was his name. He became a general after the war. He was good. He had a splendid number two, a man called who was rarely a journalist. He ran a newspaper, he wrote books, he wrote a thing, the book became a manual called Battle is the Payoff, which was sort of compulsory reading for everybody in those days. He was a wonderful man, became a great friend. What the hell was his name?
It sounds like it wasn't the personalities that were difficult, it was actually the structure, the system of command.
Oh, the system of command was... you see, whereas I could get on to Peter de Havilland and say, look, I want so-and-so, he wouldn't say, why, or couldn't you do... He'd say, right, or, sorry, we haven't got any. It's like trying to go to a garage and tell them they can't put a new plug in which has gone wrong unless they've asked you first. It's ridiculous. But the Americans, I did a lot with the Americans when they first came out to North Africa. Myself, another officer, were sent down. They'd got me, they'd lost most of their equipment, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. And I was sent, Eric sent us both, dispersed down to advise them. I went down with my normal two vehicles, my staff car and my jeep. My two drivers and my batman. And I did a recce round in general. And I came back. I went to report to the chief of staff. I'd been round, I'd seen things, etc., etc. And he said, because they always called you Dave, they didn't call you Dave, they called Dave. Dave, what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to go and get my meal. I've been away all day. He said, gee, can you get your meal now? And I said, what do you mean? I'll be trouble if I don't. But they'll look after me. I said, why? Have you had your meal? He said, no, I can't get any. I said, why not? Because chow was at such and such a time. Well, they all lined up, officers and men together, with their little mess tins. He said, if you aren't there, you can't have it. So I couldn't be there. I got to finish writing this order. So I said, have you finished your order? He said, yes, I have now. Well, come along, I'm just round the corner. So I never messed with that. I always messed by myself. And he said, will you have anything for me? I said, of course we will. Come along. So I took him along, and we were about sort of 100 yards outside that thing. There was just two vehicles, my little crew, and my batman was called Eben. He was a London tech, a random bus driver. So I called out Eben, and Eben said, enormous sir came out, and I said, we got a guess. Right, sir? I said, we'll just have a wash and then we'll be ready. So he jumped in. You asked for a wash. I said, well, of course I've asked for a wash. A bit trouble for him, he hasn't got them ready for it. And of course, there was my little canvas thing, but washing my hands, come on. And we sat down at the table, just there. And I said, do you like whiskey and soda? He said, did you say whiskey? I said, yes, of course. The end of the day's work. I want my whiskey. Don't you want yours? So we're not allowed any. Oh, I said, you're in Britain now. It's all right here. I gave him his whiskey. He had a very, very pleasant meal. They make, troops are wonderful, and if they don't make it properly, they suffer too. And they had the exact same as we did, obviously. We had a meal, and he said, "Oh, why can't we do this?" Well, why can't they? Because they believe in democracy, whatever it is. But my troops were very, very happy. They were proud of the fact that I could come tumbling back. They knew I'd been working all day. And just sit back and say, oh, thank goodness for that. That was their job. I looked after them, but they looked after me far more. But it... dear old Eben, he was worth a fortune, as far as I was concerned.
How did you collect him? Was he just assigned to you at some stage?
No, he was posted amongst the men. I used to get a bundle. I went through them, and I could allow to object anything I wanted. And I normally accepted.
Do you know how they were chosen for your particular outfit?
Well, yes, because they were chosen for nothing with any bad background could come.
No, so you were screened before they were
screened. Yes, but I was very, very, very lucky during the war that people I had. And I learned a great lesson before when we first got to Europe, the beginning of the war, when we took over a military place, and we had a thing in those days we called the sanitary corporal. And I saw the sanitary corporal, and he was very, very worried. When I saw what he'd got to do, I realized why he was worried. He'd got to clear up a most ghastly mess. Well, he did it. I must say the language was very sharp at one time, but he was doing it. But he did it, and then reported that he'd cleaned up the place, and it was all right now. And I thought, well, now, that fellow has done more to help than I've done today. And he had. And we're apt to forget the little things, that, like the loo being clean and workable, is important. It is important. And the fellow who makes it go properly and looks after it, he's jolly important. It's not a menial task, it's a very essential task in any soldier's get-up. And when you learn to respect what they do and what they are, and you think you get a better understanding of what life's all about. Well, what is deception? It's making the enemy do what you want him to do. And every single method by which the enemy gets information is vulnerable.
Did you have anything to do with counter-espionage in that case, and with dealing with enemy agents?
I never personally dealt with enemy agents till after the war. There are those whose job it is to deal with them. Let them get on with it. And the thing is to keep them controlled. You cannot have people making up things and thinking it's a good idea. And that is why in a theatre you've got one man who is totally responsible for what is done.
But what you do in theatre also relates to the level above theatre, doesn't it? Therefore you have to have some coordination from the centre.
Yeah, but I always was at the centre. You can't be anywhere else.
No, but I'm talking about what happens in the Mediterranean theatre or North Africa.
Ah, they would. Yeah, yes, but they would get a direct view, in this case from Bevan, who'd seen what was going on with us, what we wanted, and that directive would go across so that everyone would know.
So everything would be consistent.
Yes, indeed. Particularly in thing like North Africa, where Cairo was very much a gossiping shop.
And where there was also a certain division between the two armies, wasn't there? The First Army and the Eighth Army.
When we had that party, yes, but not...
Didn't affect you then?
No, because I dealt with both, you see.
Serving two masters?
My master was Alex. One master only. And he controlled a lot. The First Army was, they were new, but the Eighth Army needed controlling. I had a splendid occasion when an armored division from the Eighth Army was being moved across to the First Army area for the attack on Tunis. And the Eighth Army, of course, were terribly proud of their desert tanks, you know, they were desert people too. So one of my orders before going off was I wanted masses of green paint and paint brushes sent up by air to place where the division was. And